This is Jenka Soderberg, and I am joined in the studio today by Alaa Jaradat, who is with the Palestinian Prisoners Society. And I would like to begin with the situation of Palestinian prisoners in general.
In fact, today's statistics are about 7,400 Palestinians, plus minus. You know, the numbers fluctuate on daily basis because there are daily arrest campaigns. Detention conditions can be shortly described as inhumane detention conditions, that the conditions themselves amount to torture. With overcrowded detention facilities, continuous and repeated prevention of family visits, intentional neglect of provision of health care, denial of access to the outside world, no phone calls or exchange of mail is allowed for Palestinian prisoners, repeated attacks while inside the detention centers by guards and special units.
Can you talk about the facilities themselves? I know that there are prison camps actually out in the Negev Desert that don't even have a building.
There are three what are called open-air prisons or detention camps that until recently were controlled by the army, so they were military detention camps. These three open-air prisons are actually of tents that are dumped or disposed by the army itself. So they host Palestinian detainees and prisoners in them. And the three are one to the north of the West Bank in an area called Megiddo, and the detention center or the prison, what used to be a military detention camp called Megiddo Detention Camp. And there is one called Ofer. It's a military base and that hosts also the military courts of Ofer, and it's between Ramallah and Jerusalem. And there's the third one. It's also another military base that hosts military courts for administrative detainees. And it's just in the Negev Desert, just 5 kilometers off the borders with Egypt. So, yes, there are three open-air prisons in addition to all other civil prisons where Palestinians are held in specific security sections.
Now, Israel is an occupying power over the Palestinian territories of the West Bank and Gaza, and as such has certain responsibilities. How is it that Israel is able to justify arrest campaigns against people who are being occupied?
They try to justify, but all of the justifications or arguments that they bring are refuted by international legal community, by international law. All of those arrest campaigns are not justified. Actually, we've seen many recent calls by the United Nations, by several United Nations bodies, including a full chapter on Palestinian prisoners in the last fact-finding or investigation committee known as the Goldstone report. There's a full chapter in that report on Palestinian prisoners, whether from the West Bank, Jerusalem, including Jerusalem, 1948 Palestinian areas, or even from Gaza. So all of the arguments that they try to bring in justification for those arrest campaigns have been refuted. And for the last couple of years, we have been hearing even diplomats and political missions, including Europeans, talking or calling for Israel to release Palestinian prisoners. An Israeli academic who won recently a Nobel Prize in physics, she called for Israel to release all prisoners, though she identifies herself also as a Zionist herself.
And what about the charges? I understand that there are a number of people who are imprisoned who actually haven't been charged with anything. Can you talk about that, what Israel calls administrative detention?
For people to understand perfectly the issue of administrative detention, I might talk about the whole military order system. Since day number one in 1967, after the occupation, there was a military proclamation number one declaring the military rule over the West Bank, Gaza, or the occupied territory. And since then, those military orders followed to govern the lives of Palestinians in the occupied territory. And these military orders are about almost everything in Palestinians' lives, from where they can live, where they cannot live, and so on. And not necessarily these are have to do with security issues or security concerns of the state of Israel. These are about everything in life. If you want to dig a well, you need a permit. If you want to access your land, you need a permit from the military commander, and so on. Violations of these military orders means you are committing a security offense and you are a risk to the security of the state or the people, and thus bring you to the military tribunals, the military courts, and charge you with those offenses.
So basically, Palestinians are living under martial law.
Definitely, definitely. And it's not only in Palestinians and the occupied territory. After declaring this, the establishment of the State of Israel in 1948, Palestinians who remained on their land were not expelled or sent to diaspora, lived under the military rule, under the military commander's rule until 1966. And then in 1967, this whole military rule system was moved to the West Bank. So yes, they have been living under this military rule since the first day of occupation, and remained so until today, regardless of the agreement signed between the State of Israel and PLO. The overarching law is the military order system issued and controlled by the military commander who is responsible for the region.
So what authority does the Palestinian Authority that basically supposedly took control over the West Bank and Gaza in 1993, what control does the Palestinian Authority actually have?
It's a mockery. Though the agreement spoke about passing certain jurisdiction to the Palestinian Authority when signing the agreement, these were in fact in practice revoked, and Israel still has the overall control, and the legal status in fact did not change of the Palestinians in the occupied territory, did not change at all. So they have the right to go in, and they give themselves the right to go into any area that is supposed to be under the Palestinian Authority control, arrest, detain anybody for any kind of offense, and so on. So in practice, the Palestinian Authority has no control unless it fits the goals and the it fits the interest of the occupying power, the State of Israel.
And I want to get back a little bit to the administrative detention itself. So a Palestinian is taken from their home with a military invasion. And then what happens next to that person who has been taken under the administrative detention law or policy of the Israeli Authority?
So administrative detention, and if we hear the word administrative, is a detention that is administrative, not legal. So it's based on no legal authority and no legal ruling. So it's an order by a military commander to detain somebody for a period of time that can vary from 1 month to 6 months, based on a secret file, secret information they claim they have. Neither the detainee or a lawyer can have access to. So these people are put to detention without charges, without trial, for this period of time. But there is no limitation for how many times this order can be renewed. So basically, just on the day you are supposed to be released, or a day before, or even the last hour, or even the last minute, you will be waiting to be released, not knowing actually you are going to be released or not, and you get a renewal of your detention order. So many Palestinians have spent years under such a detention without ever being charged with any specific accusation or a specific offense, never seen trial, never knew the reasons of their detention, never had a clue about that detention. So basically an intelligence officer brings this file and this detention order with a military prosecutor, bring it to the military judge. And you have to rely on the judge, military judge, who checks this secret file and decide if they want to keep this person in prison or not. It's one of the very most harsh imprisonment types. I think people already know here in the United States about such kind of detention without charges or trial. And there have been a lot of talk recently also about this, when the new administration, Barack Obama, basically loudly said we have been wrong in detaining people, and the earlier administration has been wrong in detaining people without charges or trial, and engaged in this process to end this kind of practice. What the state of Israel does is it goes beyond even detaining people without charges or trial. They detain them without charges or trial, but these people are not even told how long they are going to stay. They can stay a few months, they can stay a few years, and every couple of months they have to wait, not knowing if they are going to be released or not. And the families wait all this time, and the lawyers wait, and the organizations wait, and you only will find out at the last minute or hour.
It seems like such detention without any charges or any trial is a clear violation of the Fourth Geneva Convention, of international law. Has your group or any other group brought charges against Israel to the International Criminal Court for this practice?
Unfortunately, to the International Criminal Court, we cannot bring any case of any violations or any war crimes or crimes against humanity that the state of Israel does, as we are stateless people. It has been, those cases have been brought to the attention of the international community, whether it's the legal international community using United Nations protection mechanisms, whether it's international under international humanitarian law or under international human rights law. But in fact, very little can be done if no political decision is not made on behalf of the overarching powers. Repeatedly, United States have used the veto when issues arrive to the Security Council. So we have the legal power is being tied by political decisions by powers like the United States of America.
But as an occupied population, the Palestinians have a protected status and are supposed to have a certain number of protections under the Fourth Geneva Convention.
Yes, they do. They do have those protections. And this is the responsibility of the high contracting parties to the Geneva Conventions, including the United States. These governments, these states, has the obligation, legal obligation, to protect the Palestinian people from such violations. But none of them has been actually active in doing so. So the protections exist. Condemnation or finding the state of Israel guilty of violations of human rights, including grave violations and war crimes and so on. Repeatedly, they found guilty by legal scholars and legal bodies, international bodies. But you need an enforcement to these protections. And these enforcements are in the hands of political powers. And the last Goldstone report, what upset so many governments, that it calls to take away this power from those political bodies to guarantee the protection of human rights internationally, not only in this case specifically.
I'm speaking this hour with Alat Jaradat, the head of Adamir, which is an organization that advocates for the rights of Palestinian prisoners imprisoned by Israeli occupying authorities. Now, Alat, I'd like to ask about the rights of Palestinian prisoners. Do they have a right to a trial? What kind of rights do they have?
The military orders, which are the laws and the martial laws, are very lax in terms of giving, of talking about rights of Palestinians. If I describe the process of arrest and detention and the regulations that they govern how people can be arrested and detained, an Israeli soldier, officer, policeman can arrest and detain a Palestinian for a period of 8 days without any reasons, without any legal procedures whatsoever. at the end of these 8 days, they are brought in front of a military judge who can decide the extension of detention without any specific accusations for questioning or interrogation and so on, which can last for a period of 180 days. During this period of time, they can prevent meeting with the lawyer for a period of 90 days. At the end of this process, people are charged in a very vague way, and Palestinian is guilty until proven innocent. It's not the vice versa how law works anywhere else in the world. This is the democracy of the state of Israel. And despite this, they still use, as we've said earlier, something called administrative detention. It's just an administrative order. So protections or rights for Palestinian prisoners are very lax and very vague. Education while you are in detention, even for children, is a luxury for Palestinians. It's not a right. Just an example of what could be.
And what about representation? Are Palestinians afforded the right to have a lawyer?
Yes, they can have a lawyer, but it's not necessarily. The court can go on without having a lawyer. But even when you have a lawyer as a detainee, as a Palestinian prisoner in front of the military court, the tools and the space given to the lawyer to protect or to debate your case is very limited, that it's almost impossible to do it. By examples, I can tell you, in one case of a Palestinian guy we were defending or representing, he was charged with two other Palestinian guys of taking part in a shooting incident. And he was denying all of these charges and said, I never took part in any shooting incident. And the accusation was like, during a period of time, during 2004, 2005, at least in one occasion, this person went out in accompanying with the other two to a shooting incident in the direction of a military jeep in a long road number, so and so. So basically talking about 2004, 2005 time space, talking about a very open area, not limited to a specific location. So it's very vague and defined very vaguely. During that process of the trial of the two other guys, it was narrowed that the accusation they are talking about or the incident supposedly took place within a month period, a specific month. When this was brought to the attention of the guy we were defending, he said, but during this month I was outside the country. So we raised this issue at the military court, and we all know, we all understand that any Palestinian who leaves or comes into the country goes through Israeli control. And this is all logged into a centralized computer system. So with two clicks, the military secretary, at the military court, she could have, just with two clicks, found out that this person, in fact, was outside the country. But no, the military judge asked us to prove that he was outside the country. So we go and we bring his passport or his travel document with the Israeli stamps of exit and entry with specific dates. During this period of time, supposedly the incident took place. And when we did so, the military judge asked us to prove that these stamps are not forged. So something we cannot prove. And the guy was found guilty. Though the system, the computerized system, knows and does tell them that he was outside the country. So even if you have a lawyer, it's close to impossible to be able to defend him.
And what about understanding the court proceedings? Palestinians speak Arabic. The occupying Israeli powers speak Hebrew. Are the proceedings translated into Arabic?
All the documents are in Hebrew. All procedures are conducted in Hebrew. There is a present at the military during the procedures or during the trial. There is a translator present at the military court, but this translator is not really a translator, could be of an Arabic-speaking soldier or some soldier who speaks a little bit of Arabic, and they just sit down there every once in a while, translate what they think is needed to be translated, and it's said in such a voice that is hardly audible for the defendants or the audience or whoever. So everything goes on in Hebrew, and the translators are not really translators. They are also soldiers. You know, the military commander who issues the military orders, who declares what is right, what is wrong, what can be done, what cannot be done, is the same military commander who assigns the military prosecutors. He's the same military commander who assigns the military judges and the secretaries at the military courts and the translators. So it's a whole military court system that all of these people are in one division in the Israeli army. They are all colleagues, and they are all reporting to the same person who issues the orders. So this one military governor, an officer, an Israeli army officer, he's the governor, he's the law, he's everything. He's the prosecutor and the judge. Everything is in the hand of one person.
And what about a recourse if a Palestinian, like the person you were just talking about, is found guilty and is innocent and has evidence showing their innocence? Is there a recourse? Is there an appeal process that Palestinian prisoners can go through?
There is only one instance, which is the Military Court of Appeals. But it's also presided by the same kinds of judges, by the same kind of military prosecutors. So what you have in the military court, first instance military court, it's the same procedures you have at the military courts of appeal. And beyond that, you have nothing. That's all. You have only two levels of appealing, of prosecution. The usual military court and the military courts of appeal.
So after a person is convicted or they're not charged and put in administrative detention, they're sent to one of these prison camps. Can their family visit them there? Are they able to have letters and phone calls?
Phone calls at no time are allowed, prevented fully. Letters can be exchanged only if they are unsealed, screened for security reasons, and through the Red Cross. That's the only way. Most of these letters never arrive at their destination because they find a reason or another to say these were prevented for security reasons. And most of the Palestinians, in fact, refrain from using these letters because even if there's nothing in there for them to, for security reasons to prevent them from reaching destination, any information written there by the family or by the detainee, even the intimate, personal, individual information. The practice has shown that the Israeli intelligence officers use it either to put more pressure and to psychologically torture the families and the detainees, or to use it to pressure them to become collaborators with them. So Palestinians refrain from using these letters. In terms of visitation, yes, families can apply for permits to visit. So they have to apply for permits from the military commanders to allow them to visit through the Red Cross, but only very few little category of people who can apply. Parents, grandparents, husbands and wives can always apply for a permit, but not necessarily granted the permit. Sons and daughters, brothers and sisters can apply for a permit if they are under the age of 16 and over the age of 46. So if you have a son who's 20 years old, he even cannot apply, let alone to get the permit. And in most of the time, families are denied, members of the family are denied the permit for security reasons or for various other reasons that they choose. Sometimes they tell the mother, deny the permit for a mother because there is no relationship between her and the person she's asking to visit, and then you have to go through a whole process of paperwork to prove the relationship and so on.
Even someone's own mother, you have to prove that relationship?
Yeah, in many cases.
Wow. So very difficult for families to even go to visit the person in prison.
Yeah, but even the visits themselves, if one goes through the trip of visiting, when just maybe one member of the family is given a permit to visit and the rest have not been given a permit to visit. When in most of the time it's very the elderly people and really young children who actually get the chance to visit. Even when people manage to visit, maybe the process itself and the trip to visit, it's such a way, torturous way, such humiliating, such a heavy experience that you start to wonder who are the more lucky people, who those who get visited or not. When a family that most of the members are denied permit to visit because for security reasons or because they do not meet the category of the family members to visit, and only you have like 4-year-old or 5-year-old children who actually get to go to visit, and you see these people from a day and 2 days and 3 days before preparing for this visit, and every member of the family telling something to those children, 4-year-old children, 5-year-old children, don't forget to say this, don't forget to tell them that, don't do this, do that, look at this, ask about that. This is like you're talking about 4 or 5-year-old children or 8-year-old children, have to remember all of this, have to skip school to go to this visit, and to remember all of these requests and to bear all of this responsibility because they need to bring in stories back or need to take stories about people getting married, people getting sick, people leaving, people dying. You know, all of these stories have to take to the visit. And the visit altogether is for 40 minutes once a month. And you have to leave the house at 2 a.m. or 3 a.m. or at 1 a.m. to get to an area where buses organized by the Red Cross will come and collect you. You get in those buses, and the buses travel through checkpoints and so on until they arrive to one area. They have to leave the buses, get all of the stuff, go through searches, get on another bus on another side that will be accompanied by Israeli security vehicles, till they arrive to the prison, and then there they are dropped outside the prison without any facilities there, without any toilets or needs there, and visitors of 8 detainees at a time or 6 detainees or 4 get into the prison at a time, and everybody else is waiting outside. They get searched outside the prison gate. Once they are entering the visitation room, they are searched, strip searched, and so on. And they go into the visitation room. They are separated from detainees by glasses or plastic and a wire mesh, and the distance between them is about 1.5 meters. So, and it's a very small visitation room where all the people on one side and the detainees, 8 detainees on the other side. So they hardly can see them, they hardly can hear them, they all have to scream and so on. And then leaving, they are strip searched again, leaving the visitation rooms. Though they had no physical contact whatsoever, they hardly heard or seen the people. And they leave out, they are searched again at the gate of the prison. And then they let visitors of another 8 detainees in, and they go through the process. And this can go on the whole day. So the visits might finish at 7 or 6 or 7 p.m. Then the buses come again, the Red Cross buses. People get on the buses, travel again to the checkpoint, switch buses, get searched, travel again. So you arrive back at home maybe at 10 p.m. or at 11 or 12 p.m. So you do a 20 hours trip or 18 hours trip to do these 40 minutes, and you hardly seen the person or hardly heard them, hardly talked to them. And then all of those who were not given the permit to visit, they are all waiting, they are all gathered in one place, just waiting for those who went to visit to come back. And they have all of those questions to ask them. A mother is asking a child, so how is he? Did he gain weight? Did he lose weight? And those people don't have the answer to that because they actually could not see it. And these are the lucky ones who get permits to visit.
You're listening to Alat Jaradat, who is the head of the Palestinian prisoners organization, Adamir. He's in Portland as the last stop of a speaking tour in the U.S. We'll be back in just a moment after this song by Michael Hart, We Will Not Go Down, which is written during Israel's invasion of the Gaza Strip earlier this year.
A blinding flash of white light lit up the sky over Gaza tonight. People running for cover, not knowing whether they're dead or alive. They came with their tanks and their planes, with ravaging fiery flames, and nothing remains. Just a voice rising up in the smoky haze. We will not go down in the night without a fight. You can burn up our mosques and our homes and our schools, but our spirit will never die. We will not go down in Gaza tonight. Women and children alike, murdered and massacred night after night. While the so-called leaders of countries afar debated on who's wrong or right. But their powerless words were in vain, and the bombs fell down like acid rain. Through the tears and the blood and the pain, you could still hear that voice through the smoky haze. We will not go down in the night without a fight. You can burn up our mosques and our homes and our schools, but our spirit will never die. We will not go Gaza tonight. We will not go down in the night without a fight. You can burn up our mosques and our homes and our schools, but our spirit will never die. We will not go down in the night without a fight. We will not go down in Gaza tonight.
We will not go down. By Michael Hart. We now return to Alat Jaradat, who's here in the KBOO studio while touring the U.S. to talk about the issue of Palestinian prisoners held by the Israeli military authorities. You've just described the conditions for families going to visit someone who has been imprisoned by the Israeli authorities. And now I myself have visited people on death row in the U.S., and even that visit for people who are accused of murder is not anywhere near as difficult as what you've described. And these Palestinians are not accused of murder, or are they?
No. These people could have been accused of trying to access their piece of land that is behind the wall. It's their own piece of land that is behind the wall, trying to access it without the right permit from the military commander. It means you are violating the military laws and you are committing a security offense, and you will be subject to arrest and detention and prosecution. So it could be anybody. It could be a student who has been active on campus within one of the student groups, which is also illegal. You know, all sorts of associations are illegal, including student unions or workers' unions. So it could be anything. It could be a 14 or 15-year-old child who has been accused of throwing stones at an armored personnel carrier of the Israeli army. So, no, not necessarily accused of anything serious.
And what we've been hearing about recently, our regular listeners will be familiar with the situation in Belayin. We've had reports from Iyad Bornat on a fairly regular basis recently about arrest campaigns against nonviolent organizers, organizers of the nonviolent protests. Do you think that type of arrest campaign has stepped up in recent months against the nonviolent movement?
I won't say stepped up. Overall policies, yes, maybe there are a lot of restrictions, a lot of crackdown on all of the movement in several areas in the West Bank in terms of activists, nonviolent activists or activists against the wall. But this is, if we compare it in general to the history of the Palestinian movement in the occupied territory, these kinds of crackdowns have been going on all the way through since the occupation. Student activism, university activism, and protests have been attempted, have been tried by the Palestinians over years and years and years. And the same kind of crackdown, at times, even the instructions to the Israeli military were even more lax than this. During the first intifada, this meant the use of lethal weapons, shot to kill for somebody who, for example, writes a graffiti on the wall, or someone who raises a Palestinian flag. So I wouldn't say a step up, but in terms of to compare to recent history, yes, there has been a lot of arrests. There are many arrests. In fact, Ad-Damir lately issued a whole analysis report on the issue of arrests regarding and in connection to the wall and protests against the wall. And yes, there are very notable policies and trends in terms of arrest and detention.
Earlier you mentioned that Israeli authorities tried to get some people to be collaborators in exchange for a lighter sentence. How much are collaborators used by the Israeli authorities, and are they used in a way that that they will convict people who are the only evidence against them is the word of a collaborator, for instance?
It is used like information given to them by a collaborator. It is used, but mostly this is used in administrative detention cases where the military judge will say, for over fear of the source of information, I cannot disclose the secret information we have, and so on. But this is not the scary part of it, how they use information from collaborators to prosecute Palestinians. The scary part is when they use many, many things related to the lives of the Palestinian people to force them to become collaborators, like a 17-year-old young Palestinian who will be finishing school is pressured to become a collaborator and threatened that he will never get to a university or will never be allowed to travel outside to study, and so on, that they will ruin his career and his life, and so on. Or somebody whose father, for example, or brother or sister is in need for health care and they need to travel either outside the country or need a permit to get health treatment in an Israeli hospital, for example, and they are really chantaged, really try to exchange this to give them even the chance to seek treatment and health treatment with working for them. Especially the pressure to get collaborators is in age category. It's very common of the age category, like 14 to 16 year olds, and you're talking about pressuring children 14 to 16 year olds to become collaborators. And this is equal like what the world says, recruiting people, recruiting children to into an armed struggle, but the world won't talk about this. So it's very scary.
And your group has documented cases where this has happened?
It's hard to document such cases because of children, especially when it comes to children, are scared even to talk that they were offered or they are being pressured. because they fear that people might not believe them that they did not agree. It's very difficult to do that. But yes, there are a lot of documents on this, but it's not enough. We think in general children are even afraid to mention that they have even been offered that.
Again, I'm speaking with Alaa Jaradat, who is with Adamir, which is a Palestinian Prisoners Support and Human Rights Association. Has your group, Adamir, come under any type of scrutiny or attack for the work that you do?
There are a lot of restrictions, mounting restrictions on our kind of work. Many times, us or people like us get under a lot of trouble. Either restriction on movement or making the lives of the lawyers, for example, difficult, or preventing us from traveling or doing this kind or that kind of work. Direct attacks, maybe in 2002, when they deployed all or invaded the Israeli army, invaded all the Palestinian towns, our offices came under attack, direct attack, like many other Palestinian organizations. But in general, they try to do what they keep trying to do is to find a way to close down these organizations, the ones like us, and they have managed, and they've done this to many other organizations working with prisoners, for example. They shut them down, confiscate their property, arrest people working with them. So restrictions and harassment and so on, they are repeated, and sometimes they become extreme, sometimes not. But we are always working under this kind of fear. We don't know what will happen tomorrow or the day after. For example, I'm here traveling the United States talking about these issues. I don't know if on my way back I will be arrested or not. I don't know.
What justification does the Israeli military give for attacking and harassing these organizations that work for human rights?
They always try to say that these organizations, they are a cover-up, they are not human rights organizations, they are just a facade for this or that terrorist organization. You know, this is the usual attempts to justify these attacks.
And have they succeeded in shutting down other organizations?
Yeah, repeatedly in the history, they have been able to shut down many organizations. Like if if you arrest one or two, three people in a row that work for one organization and charge them with being members of this or that other than the organization, then they immediately say, this organization is basically one of those groups. So they shut it down and so on. The last few years, they shut three organizations that work with Palestinian prisoners.
And I do want to wrap this up, but I wanted to get back to some of the conditions faced by Palestinian prisoners. One story that I have heard is about Palestinian women who have been imprisoned, some of them pregnant, some of them with small children, or they have their children in prison. What happens in that situation?
And if a Palestinian woman who got arrested, detained while pregnant, and she was in prison at the time to give birth, it's extremely difficult. It's hard to talk about even. First, they are not given any special treatment or special nutrition or any special conditions of detention. They just remain in detention under the same conditions, under the same inhuman conditions that all the rest of the Palestinian women prisoners are detained under. Once it comes to giving birth, they are not giving any special treatment. In fact, maybe last year people heard about a very important case of the woman who was given. They moved her out of the prison to a hospital to give birth. She had to give birth while she was her hands and legs were tied to the bed, were cuffed to the bed, and in half an hour after giving birth, she was taken back to the prison, and the situation inside the prison and the conditions were not changing. No special nutrition for her, nothing special for the child, and at many times while the child was in there with his mother, the guards will attack either with tear gas or with water hoses or something, attack the section where these women prisoners are, and there was no consideration for the presence of a child in there.
And I know some people may have heard of the case of Manal Ghanem and her son Noor. It's one case that we have covered here before, that her child was with her until he was 3 years old in the prison. Do you know about that case in particular?
Yeah. This is a case, this is a campaign that we launched, Abdamir actually launched, to release Manal and her son Noor. You know, under Israeli prison system orders, a child or a mother that has a child who is under the age of two can be with her inside the prison until the age of two. At the age of two, the child has to be sent out, has to leave prison and be separated from his mother. It's difficult to decide and to choose between forcing a one-year-old child or a two-year-old child to separate with his mother and to be sent out separately, or to argue that this child should remain with his mother but in prison. So our campaign for Manal Ghanem and her son Noor was to release them both, but in order to reach that, we also tried, we did not, because the whole family situation, there was nobody to take care of the child outside and so on. We tried to keep the child with his mother as long as possible, not to be sent outside, because at that moment the conditions and the situation was even worse outside, so he could not have had the right care and the considerable care. She's released now. She's fine and with her son. I don't know if they will ever recover, if Noor will grow up without any trauma. But no, they're coping with help of families and friends and so on. They are coping.
I know that when Noor was first released at age three, he did suffer a lot of psychological trauma.
We could see this because our lawyers, we managed at one point to get a psychiatrist and a sociologist to go with the lawyer, to accompany the lawyer, to see Manal and Noor. And it was obvious, yes, that the child, that Noor, will be facing a lot of problems. First, he was living in a woman's world while in detention, and the only males that the child was exposed to were guards attacking the section or ordering or and so on. So he was constantly afraid of of the presence of any male around, and he was used to the women's world only. So yes, was difficult the first time when he was released. The good thing, he was released with his mother at the same time, so around the same time. That's the good part, that he managed to, you know, slowly be integrated and be rehabilitated. We won't know now if that will be total recovery or no remnants of any trauma will remain. It's hard to say now.
And a Palestinian, once they are released from prison, how does that, having been a prisoner, follow them? I understand that there is a certain notation that's made either in the ID or in the Israeli computer system that they have been a prisoner.
In the computer system, definitely. In the ID, it's not anymore there, because now with all of this computerized system, any military jeep can just type in an ID number and they will know the full history. So they do not have this notation anymore. It used to be in the 80s and early 90s that you get even marked from a distance just by seeing it without even looking at the ID. They will know if you have been in prison. But today it's kind of difficult to say this has a big meaning. When we talk about 750,000 or 800,000 Palestinians have been to prison or jail at least once in their lives. So we talk about a huge number, maybe like 3 out of 5 Palestinian males, adult males, have been to prison. So it's it's covering, it's almost everybody has experienced that. But there is still an annotation in the computer system. Yes, people still, the vast majority of those who have been at least once in prison, they still go through plenty of difficulties in their lives afterwards on checkpoints while traveling, trying to get to move somewhere or to work somewhere and so on. Yes, their lives get affected until death. Like, you know, you've been once in prison, then it's different.
And now you're here in the U.S. on tour. What are you hoping that people in the U.S. will do in order to affect change in the situation of Palestinian prisoners?
This is my last stop. It will be this evening at 7 p.m. at the university. It will be the last event in the speaking tour that has been for the last 3 weeks. And our intention was, we wanted to focus at the beginning about around one issue of detention, which is administrative detention, the kind of arbitrary detention, collective punishment and torture of what of this kind of detention. But going through this tour, we had to cover all sorts of issues related to the issue of Palestinian political prisoners. What we expect people to do is to get active on this, active against any sort of political repression, political prosecution, political detention, the use of torture, arbitrary detention, and so on. And people should become active, especially at these times in the United States, where there are mounting pressures and mounting also political prosecutions and political repressions here in the United States. Historically, this is the last issue of human rights issues that people become active to, because maybe they are afraid of what of the connotation of what this, you know, when talking about prisoners, it's connotated something. So they might be active around attacks on civilians, but not active around political detention or prisoners. And we want to break this kind of barrier, and we want people to get active on it. We want this kind of campaigning to become a campaign in the United States, not only a campaign there. And also there is a lot of issues related to each other here in the United States and here. First, United States is the strongest ally, the best ally of the State of Israel, and all of those violations by the State of Israel without the support of the United States will not happen. Secondly, much of this kind of work is of these kind of violations can happen only because of the financial support of the United States. $3 billion in direct military aid reaches up to $10 billion a year in various forms of aid, and actually there is very little to no transparency on what the State of Israel gets in terms of support. So people of the United States actually are paying, and these are taxpayers' money. They are paying for these violations, and without their money, those violations might be limited, might stop altogether. So people have to take action. It's their responsibility to act on this. It's their responsibility to do something to prevent the use of torture. It's their responsibility to do something to prevent arbitrary detention without charges or trial. Today, we have a new administration in the United States. It's different than the earlier administration. Maybe it's not perfect. Maybe it's not what people will wish for, but it's different. The earlier administration there was no access to it, no way to access the change or to force a change in that administration. Today's administration, there is a small window to influence it, and we should seize this moment. We should be active. We should not hesitate in exerting pressure on this administration to change its policies and to stop this support to the State of Israel, especially that they have been loudly talking about that it's wrong, we have been wrong, we are wrong to detain people without charges or trial. Either we release those people, send them home or to wherever. Maybe they are giving them to other countries who will detain them arbitrarily. But this government, this administration, says it's wrong to detain people without charges or trial. So this government, this administration, has to tell its ally, its best friend, that they also should stop doing that, should end it. And it's up for the people here to do this kind of activism. We also believe that we, as Palestinians, as human rights organizations, human rights activists on the ground, we are limited in terms of space to work or to influence a change by this Israeli military system, this occupation. And the force and the power to change can come from outside. We need this to end those violations. The pressure should come from outside, be it through lobbying, letter writing to representatives, and trying to influence a change in the political discourse here, or people have to take action themselves directly in terms, for example, to be active in divestment, in boycott campaigns, and so on here. Everybody maybe does not understand that those military prosecutors, for example, military judges, are not necessarily only soldiers and serving or working as soldiers. They could be in day-to-day life somebody else, like a doctor or an academic or a lawyer practicing law or so on. So there are a lot of chances that these people might be involved in certain projects with companies or with organizations or with institutes here in the United States, but that yet they serve as military prosecutors. They take direct action or direct involvement in violations. So people have to dig down and see what they can do about it.
And again, I'm speaking with Alat Jaradat, who is with Adamir, which is a Palestinian Prisoner Support and Human Rights Association. Their website for more information is adamir.info. That's Adamir with two D's and two E's, adamir.info. I want to thank you very much for joining us today, Alat Jaradat. This is Jenka Soderberg with KBOO News.
اسمعوا